You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is once again Trevor Carlson, who joins me for part two of Cage, Cunningham, and Food, part one of which took place last week. For those just tuning in this week, Trevor Carlson was the last executive director of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company after serving for many years as its company manager. Trevor and Merce became fast friends, and given my own relationship with Merce after John Cage's death, this meant that Trevor and I quickly became fast friends as well. We together saw Merce through the end of his life in 2009, learning an enormous amount along the way. Food was very important in the Cage Cunningham household, as well as on the road, and we were both privileged to be a critical part of that, especially as Merce waned. There's a lot of laughter in this program, only because there were many, many funny moments. Enjoy. So welcome back, Trevor. This is part two of Laura and Trevor talking about Cage Cunningham and food. You touched on something at the end of our conversation last week, and that was that the kitchen was such a hub for guests in the house. If we could manage four, if we only had four, we spent a lot of time in the kitchen, eating in the kitchen and cooking in the kitchen with people around. And it definitely was a center place. We also did, remember, we would do Thanksgiving dinners for all the orphans. We used to call them the orphans. Do you remember?
Christmas dinner too. You did Christmas dinners.
And Christmas, well. Exactly. People that didn't have anywhere to go, didn't have families. And we would just do a big turkey and it was nice. But that was, of course, after Merce changed his diet to accommodate meats. I remember his favorite things after he adopted a taste for red meat, like some sort of, you know, jungle animal. He loved chili. You remember, he loved chili. He loved meatloaf.
Yeah.
He just kind of opened the dietary possibilities in the house became much greater.
But he only really trusted them in the house. So when we would leave and go somewhere else, it was kind of back to the macrobiotic deal.
Always. And even in New York, weren't there just two or three restaurants that we would go to with any regularity. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the name of that place. What was it? Right down by the studio, down near Bethune. Carib. Remember Carib? Yeah, it was a Caribbean restaurant.
Yeah. There was also the that really great a sushi restaurant that we would go to in Soho. Nobu, it was the other one.
Not Nobu. Nobu was for special occasions. That was good too, but it was the one that was half the price.
Yeah, and we met up with Richard Gere there, who we got to talk to because of the relationship we had with his brother, David Gere.
That's right, and I made a complete fool of myself when he wanted to meet Merce. He saw us. He was right next to us, right behind us. Yeah. And he came over and I said, "Oh my God, it's Richard Gere. I'm a huge fan of your brother." I felt so foolish. And he said, "It's okay. People say that all the time."
I remember that. That was so good.
David Gere.
Yeah.
Who used to teach in the dance department at UCLA. Right.
Yeah. And he wrote a lot about dance.
Exactly. But talk about touring a little bit more, Trevor. Like, I was always amazed that there was so much. I mean, there was so much that went on tour anyway, costumes and props and music stuff and instruments. But talk about food. Like, how did Cage and Cunningham both? I can speak to Cage a little bit, but with Cunningham, how did he cope with travel?
We took a lot of things with us. And there were things that traveled with the touring equipment, like cooking supplies, and in some cases, grains like rice and things like that. Were almond butter was always in Merce's road box. Raisins were always in Merce's road box. we're always concerned when we were crossing borders that we might, the freight might get stopped.
I remember them, by the way, when we went to Australia, going back to that, yeah, that one particular trip where they confiscated his buckwheat pillows.
Yes.
Do you remember that? He was, yeah, beside himself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we traveled with a lot of things, but we weren't the only ones who traveled with a lot of things. I think that Cage had a bit of an influence on the dancers and the musicians of the company. David Tudor was famous for cooking a lot on tour and backstage and in his hotel room and buying spices from different parts of the world to bring back to home. But more than anything, what I remember, because Tudor wasn't there and Cage wasn't there when I was with the company, what I remember was walking through the halls of the theater and where the dressing rooms were, and all sorts of incredible smells coming out of the dressing room.
They must have loved you.
Because the dancers in their dance bags and their traveling kits that we took responsibility for getting from one city to the next, almost all of them at the time that I started with the company had a rice cooker in their dance bag, and they cooked in their rooms during rehearsal and would eat a little something after rehearsal before performance and then have a little leftover for dinner after the show. And yeah, that was the culture of the company. But Merce didn't, when I was there, we were not cooking so much when we were on tour, but we were taking a lot of things with us. He had, as you know, his lunch routine, which consisted of almond butter, whole wheat pita, and raisins, and he ate that every single day for lunch, whether it was in New York at the studio, at home on the weekends, or on tour. That was a real staple, until eventually I think that lunch changed. You might know the reason it did. I don't know if I remember, but it changed at one point to include or transition from the almond butter to hummus. Do you remember? There was a certain point where his lunch moved to being a hummus with the pita bread.
Yeah, I don't remember when that took place. Hummus was, as you probably recall, Trevor, a real staple, yeah, in the household. I mean, we almost always had hummus, and we always had tabbouleh.
Yeah.
We loved Abraham's tabbouleh. Was, yeah, the absolute best that you could buy in New York. And people, yeah, would come to dinner and they would bring him some special tabbouleh from someplace and not even disclose where they got it, because it was, they made it in short, you know, there was a short supply of it. They didn't want us raiding that store.
Yeah, I remember Mickey Wesson used to bring.
That's exactly tubs. Right. I was thinking of Mickey. No, it's true. And John, I always remember, well, wait, but there's a thought that I had relative to what you were just saying about Merce. You know, he used to talk about, and I'm sure he shared this with the dancers, that it was a real discovery for him to realize that really changing his diet made him a better dancer, that he would, you know, go out and eat a cheeseburger and French fries, and then he wasn't as good a dancer on the stage. Yeah. Or he had intestinal difficulties of one kind or another. And well, he said all of that stopped when he shifted over to the macrobiotic diet.
Yeah, he attributed a lot of joint issues with the dairy and his diet. And once he removed the dairy from his diet, he explained that issues around with his knees, with his shoulders, really diminished because of that single ingredient.
Yeah, and that never changed. You know, we were talking, to remind the audience, we were talking about Merce Cunningham's adopting meat, later in his life when he became more infirm and he was thin and he was anemic and he was having all these sort of issues with aging. And it was recommended to him to add red meat to his diet to sort of bulk up a little bit. So that got adopted, but we never, ever, ever adopted dairy. Mm-hmm. Right? There was nothing that was brought into the house. I remember you going through a kick with sorbets. You were bringing sorbets for a while, like chocolate chip and things like that, which he gobbled right down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing when, like when we, as we're talking about this, how much in Merce's, my experience with Merce, how much food played a part in almost every aspect of what it was that he was doing, even in a certain sense, it permeated even more all aspects of his life than dance itself did.
Huh, that's interesting.
Do you know, like, it just seemed to be, even at the end, if you'll remember those last 3 weeks at home, it was just sort of, it was the measure of what kept him going. It was the means to having a social interaction with others. It was a change of scenery and general from his focus having almost 70% of the time been on making a dance and being with dancers. So it played a large role in my experience with Merce.
No, me too. I was just remembering back. It was also, I remember, you know, he was always generous with his appreciation, always, you know, no matter how bad things got for him toward the end, he was always very appreciative of us and, mm-hmm. and doing that. And I recall one person was Elizabeth Streb. I don't know why that particular time comes to mind, because it happened all the time. And that is that we would go to a concert and then we would bring a couple of people home.
Yeah.
To have a bite, you know, and to be social. And he was always so amazed that either one of us or together could go into what he considered a relatively empty refrigerator and put something together, you know, make something that was festive and delicious. And it's still one of my favorite ways to cook, actually, is to not necessarily go spend $50 at Whole Foods, but kind of see what's in there, poke around the refrigerator and put something together, you know.
And you know what, though, I feel like as amazed as he might have been at that, it was like my dabbling with what his manner of making his dances was all about, you know, this kind of like chance procedure in the kitchen sort of
right,
thing.
Right. It's the same. It was the same. It was absolutely the same.
Do you remember?
I also remember, going back to touring just for a second, because there's just so many memories I have of this, of, you know, the preparation for a tour. And it always had to do with shopping and getting food stuff, you know, not just to take with him, but preparing the meal for the plane. You know, he was flying in first class for a good decade before he died. And he would nonetheless have his little, you know, Tupperware containers with all of his little bits and baubles of food that he would eat on the plane. They would come and they would want to serve him. He would tell me horror stories about what the people around him were eating, you know. It's a horrible piece of meat with gravy poured over it and, oh, horrors, you know. No, not that. And Kate was the same. To this day, you know, John used to make the most delicious thing. And to this day, I make this whenever I think of it. He used to take plain tempeh and he would marinate it in lemon if he couldn't find lemon broil tempeh. And then he would broil it. He would marinate it in lemon juice for like an hour. And then he would broil it and he would put it on a piece of pita bread with slices of onion and hummus and just roll it up. And that was lunch. These good sized chapatis, you know, kind of. And he would eat that on the plane and he would get to destination and feel just fine where everybody else had indigestion, you know.
Yeah,
they both drank a good deal, but beyond that, they were pretty austere.
Yeah, it was always the way back home that was the greatest challenge, like refilling from a city that you maybe didn't know so well, refilling the Tupperware containers for the flight home.
Yeah.
That's always a challenge.
I can tell you, Trevor, one time when John and I were coming, it was the Italy trip, and we were coming back, and well, that trip was hard in another way, and that was I couldn't find bananas. In the town, wherever it was, Perugia, I think it wasn't Florence. I just literally could not find bananas, no matter where I went. And he thought he was going to die because it was such a staple.
Yeah.
He didn't die. But the other thing was that he, going to exactly what you were just saying, we got to the airport and there was just, we didn't have anything. You know, we had some cereal, I think, which he would eat with lukewarm tea poured on it. Which is actually quite good. It's a, you know, a reasonable thing to do. But I remember being in the first class lounge and him overeating macadamia nuts. And he was not, I won't say sick as a dog, but he was pretty unhappy on the airplane, you know, because he had probably eaten 20 of those little packs of macadamia nuts in the first class lounge. It's pretty sad. It became a very, for Cage, just like Cunningham, this physical and psychological dependence upon a particular way of eating that they were convinced if it got disturbed, they were not going to be well, you know. And I think that was probably partly real, but partly brought on by the unwillingness to partake of something that maybe wasn't exactly right, but would have been better than eating 20 packages of macadamia nuts. You know,
and I can't help but think that that had something to do with past experience, you know. I mean, really having been sick in one moment or another and having had to perform on top of it, or I don't ever recall a specific story, but I definitely had the same sense that you just described, which was it was physical as much as it was psychological, the dependence on this particular diet and their well-being, which makes great sense for people who are traveling to different parts of the world and rely on their instrument is their body
and their energy, you know. They needed to keep that up. And for somebody, you know, Cage died at 79. That Italy tour was the last tour he did, and he wasn't 100% to begin with. So if you take away a staple from the diet for a period of weeks, it scared him. Like he needed to stay to that regime. You know, he went to Russia. I want to say this was more like 89. He went to Russia on invitation. And well, there's so many things to say about that trip, but apropos this conversation, when he got back, and he was only gone for about a week, maybe 10 days max. And when he got back, he was thin and gray. I mean, he really looked like crap, you know. And I said, it came out later that day. It's like, you know, what happened? What happened over there? And he said, Lord, there was nothing to eat that hadn't been cooked in chicken fat, that hadn't been cooked in schmaltz, you know. And I said, so you just stopped eating? Like, how do you adapt? Merce was much better at adapting. You know, he would make do, but he wasn't happy. But he had a good survival mechanism. Yeah. But John, he said they lived on greens, foraged greens, and vodka.
Yeah.
For like 10 days. And he came home, really, it took weeks to get color back in his cheeks. You know, it was pretty dire.
They were healthy drinkers, the two of them, weren't they? I remember red wine was always involved.
Yeah.
And I mean, Merce was never, I don't think he had a problem per se, but it was definitely part of the when we shopped, remember, we had the account with
we had an account at the local liquor store. No question. I mean, the stories I've told in the show. I did a show with Lawrence Wojtek.
Oh, cool.
Who worked with Rauschenberg for 25 years as his principal studio assistant. And we talked about the two of them drinking, which probably didn't go over well with certain people out in the world about Rauschenberg. But they were both really good drinkers. And what something that came out in that conversation, which I never thought about, it was that Lawrence allowed that for Bob Rauschenberg, drinking gave him fire so that he drank to work. It brought out all of that in him, all that creative juice came out. And for John, it like made him go to sleep. It was, John couldn't drink and work at the same time. If he drank, work stopped. So that probably actually kept Cage from being an alcoholic. Yeah. Because, you know, it inhibited so much of his life if he drank.
Yeah, I think similarly for Merce, don't you? That it was a kind of end of day relax sort of state of mind. One of my favorite personal stories was having been with Bob Rauschenberg and Merce at Harry's Bar in Venice, and leaving, the two of them having had their share, and Daryl and I having had our share as well, and trying to get onto the Vaporetto, and both, we had to lift them under their armpits and hoist them onto the Vaporetto, and by chance, Daryl and I both stepped off the dock at the same time, and the Vaporetto separated from the dock, and we were in a split, holding Merce facing Bob, and Daryl holding Bob facing Merce, and they both just broke down in laughter. We looked doomed, as if they were just going straight into the...
And you didn't?
We didn't, no. I don't know who it did it, but we were pulled back to the dock, and we made it onto the...
Oh my God.
But there was something about just the introduction of wine, and wine for Merce. I think that's all I ever saw him really drink. But the introduction of alcohol into the story that made me remember, not defending, but how shocked people were when asking Merce if he and John, like if part of the mushroom thing had to do with like psychedelic mushrooms.
Right,
So many people suspected that John and Merce were getting high in the early days. Okay. And how Merce, I don't think it was a show. I think he was quite sincere. It never really appealed to him, none of any of those things. That was never any of the reason, as I understand it, for Cage's interest in mushrooms.
Not at all. And in fact, and people would ask me that about Cage as well, just in general, even not about mushrooms, but he knew Cage and Timothy Leary knew each other. And Timothy Leary was interested in Cage, you know, involving himself with LSD. And I asked John, you know, I said, you never did. And he said, oh, Laura, it seems to me the mind is complicated enough. He said, yeah, me too. I remember a really funny thing with Cage. So Cage had an addictive personality. I mean, he would overdo anything. He would overdo cough drops, you know, if he got a buzz off of it, clearing his sinuses, he would eat them all day, you know, kind of thing. But I remember him, I was living with Electra York when I first worked with Cage in 86, 87, I guess it was. And we gave a party. We threw a party and John and Merce both came, and they both imbibed a lot. John even drank like two little cups of espresso out the door. He was like grabbing one, drinking it, and Merce is saying, come on, big guy, let's go, you know. And they only lived, for our audience, they lived about a mile up Sixth Avenue from Electra's house, literally as a crow flies, just straight up. So I don't know if they took a cab or they walked, but I suspect they took a cab. They were both careening. I go to work the next morning and I walk in the house. Merce hasn't quite left yet. He's getting himself together. And I walk in the house. I don't see John anywhere. And there's a blanket on the floor. And apparently, Merce said, scowling, that unapprovingly, that when they walked in the house, John passed out on the floor, just passed out from sheer volume of alcohol and caffeine both. Merce went and got a blanket, hobbled into the bedroom, got a blanket, threw it on him, and went to bed. So John was in the bathroom, I guess, showering or something. But I don't, now that I'm thinking about this, I don't remember Merce ever being drunk.
He had no patience for people who were drunk either. I think he was never drunk that I saw.
Because he was mad when John got drunk and passed out. It just irritated him.
And it infuriated him when he saw it as well, especially the next day, and dancers who would show up to rehearsal
Yes, and they would reek of alcohol from the night before,
or
kind of thing.
He didn't really tolerate that, I don't think, so much.
He said a really beautiful thing to me once that, again, talking about his kind of generosity of spirit to other kinds of people. I think that he may not have liked to be around drunks, but he said once, I was talking about someone in my family being attracted to bad boys, one of my sisters being attracted to bad boys. And I said something to the effect of, her current husband is addicted to everything. He's a gambler and he drinks and he likes to do cocaine and he likes this and he likes that. And Merce just looked at me and he said, poor fellow, he has no restraint. Isn't that nice? And it's like, yeah, I guess that's one way to put it. I've been thinking he's a loser. And Merce says he just has no restraint. But Merce always seemed to, as much as he liked wine, because he really, really enjoyed it. It was something you remember when when we were permitted to up the price on the bottles, when we would go to Crossroads and
That's
buy a case of
good.
wine. And in the beginning, when we were charged with doing this, when he sort of wasn't so ambulatory anymore, and he would, we would be like around the $15 bottle, $15 a bottle. Of course, Jasper sort of ruined that because on one of Merce's big birthdays, he sent a case of, I don't even know, it was like Rothschild or something. It was so fantastic, the wine. I don't know what that would have been a bottle, $300 or something. But I remember Merce kind of pulling me aside one day and saying, well, the next time you go see George at Crossroads, maybe you could go to 25. Like, oh, okay.
I just think that there was so much tied to his associated to his body and his work with his body that didn't allow certain extremes, like with the alcohol or with certain foods on tour. It just all seemed to be really so closely connected to how did it make him feel physically? Even at the end, you remember like his conversations, those last days were really based so much around his curiosity of what his body was experiencing those
Right.
days.
Do you
Less about
remember, Trevor, the it was in the last year, and he one of his favorite things to eat was blue corn chips. Do you remember his sunny blues with the sunflower seeds in them and with hummus? I mean, almost every day. And he either overdid it or his body was having troubles, whatever, but it bothered his stomach. And he never ate them again after that. It was just he had cut them off because they didn't, they made him feel bad. And nothing I said was going to change. Like I said, you try a few, I'm quite sure that wasn't it. Your body was, you were just having maybe a little flu or something. I don't know. But he never ate corn chips again after that.
It was also a conversation piece, the diet, their diet. It was a conversation piece, certainly for Merce. And I've heard a lot of stories from different people who had dinner experiences with both of them. And who was it that Barbara Schwartz spoke so much about how John would come to dinner parties she would have and bring Tupperware containers and
in his picnic basket. He would come in with this picnic basket. She would have to take this glop, whatever it was, and put it on her good china, you know, and put it down. And it made, I think they liked being as they were in their work against the grain, you know, it was different. They were different, you know, and they wouldn't think of going to a dinner party without bringing their own food because they couldn't eat what was going to be put in front of them.
Yeah.
It irritated some people, but other people I think enjoyed it. You know, they were the characters.
Well, it also played a huge part. The story you've told before about the memorial for John and ordering the food from, I can't remember where. What was it?
Yeah, it was. No. It was Colonel Sanchez. Colonel Sanchez was a line of frozen Mexican foods. And
They were
tamales.
Tamales.
Yeah. Catherine Bennett is her name. Catherine Bennett. She was Colonel Sanchez. Yes. And they ordered those. Merce had me ordered them from California. And instead of shipping them, because you couldn't get them in any quantity, Catherine said, I'd like to come. Can I bring them? And I said, wow, that'd be like service with a smile. But I think you could do that. I don't know if I ever told you this. And so she had like six cases of these tamales that John and Merce both enjoyed so much. And they were frozen in California. And she's now going to bring them on the airplane. And it turned out that it was frightfully expensive to handle them like checked luggage.
Yeah.
So she told the ticket agent that she was just going to take them on the plane. And the ticket agent said, you're never going to get those through security. There, you have too much stuff. So she goes, she's telling me this story, and it's like, Catherine, so what happened? This is another time we have to appreciate. This would never work now. And she said she got to the check-in, where you go check-in, and she's got these six boxes of frozen tamales. And I said, and they let you on? And she goes, well, I had $100 bills in my pocket. And she said, I just would peel them off. It's like, are you sure I can't do this? Are you sure I can't do this? She said it took three or four. She couldn't remember, but it was still way under what it would have cost to check these boxes through.
Amazing.
I remember she at the wake. Oh, you didn't come to the wake.
No,
because you didn't know KJ.
I wasn't there yet. No.
But so at the wake, she had these tamales, but it was too quick. So she got there and they were still half frozen. And all she had was like those little Sterno candles kind of, and she was trying to get these to thaw. Cook them that people could eat them. Oh my God, it was funny. And even, you're right, Trevor, you know, another thing that happened, I don't know if Merce told you this, two things actually. He wanted all of John's favorite things. So the Colonel Sanchez tamales were one, his cage cookies, you know, he loved those cookies, guacamole. And he had me make cookie dough and then put it into baggies, and all the dancers took it home the night before and were responsible for making two or three cookie sheets of cookies.
Amazing.
I know. He just liked this idea, and that we made the guacamole in the office. We had vats of avocados, and everybody, when they had a break, would come and make guacamole in the office. It was incredibly touching.
That, I think that was the part that I was kind of like suggesting in a bit when discussing the wafting and the hallways of the theaters of great food coming from the rooms. The influence that I think particularly John had on the dancers extended to all aspects of their lives, in a sense. It was When Cage died, I was not working for Cunningham, but I was dating one of the dancers of Cunningham. And I remember how personal it felt to all of them that it was as it was equal to having a parent or relative.
Interesting, interesting. It was Merce's idea, the sharing of the baking, the group making of guacamole. That was his idea. I was the reverse of you in that I worked with Cage, but I had very little connection with Merce before John died. And Merce wanted it that way. You know, I was one of the many people that Cage had in his house, you know, so that when Merce came home, really the rule was that I not be there. It wasn't personal. He didn't even know me. We hardly knew each other. I didn't really get to know Merce until really just kind of right before John died, because John kind of put us together in the house.
I had the sense that you were training me when I came along. Did you feel like that you were kind of training me to be there with you in the kitchen, or did that just is that a creation in my mind? Because I certainly felt like I came to work for that company and work and happened to get close to Merce. There was no reason for the company manager to be doing what I was doing. And I just remember feeling like this really welcoming, not just by Merce, but by you as well, and that you really taught me what I know about cooking.
I don't think that that was a conscious thing, Trevor. I think it was a way of simply just including you, you know, of that you were going to be with us a lot. Merce was really, really fond of you, as you well know. So he wanted you around. And so it was, I'm sure I just went in that direction with him because I liked you very much. And, you know, so I thought, great, Trevor's going to need to know how to do this too. We can share this.
Well, it was
Another
nice
fr
because we were able to lean on each other and at the same time and enjoy so much of those experiences together.
Absolutely. We used to make Merce nuts
I
because
know.
we would do giggle stuff, you know, or we would do silly things, and he would just say, "Can we go now? Are we ready?" Do you know the first thing, you know, going back to the wine for a second, because another thing is he may not have been, he certainly was not anywhere near an alcoholic, and he never drank to excess that I really saw. He might have drank to sleep, but you know, he never drank to imbibe himself, I don't think, or to become imbibed. But he was a wine snob, you know, he was really a wine snob. And the very first thing he ever said to me, ever. We were in the Fundus, which was the bar of the Frankfurt Opera. And we were all there for John's Year Operas 1 and 2 in this would have been 87. So early on, early. And I walked into the Fundus where everybody was. John was there, Merce was there, some of the staff, some of the performers. And I sat down, and the bartender or the server person came over to take drink orders from whoever had just joined. I was among them. And I ordered a glass of white wine. And Merce said, first thing he ever said to me, white wine. And then he went, it's like his little snort that he would do. And he said, what a waste. I remember feeling slightly indignant, like, you know, see a big guy.
That could have been a carryover from influences that people like Tini Duchamp had on wine drinking, because wasn't it Tini who taught them just add in the summer, all you need to do is add a cube of ice to the
That's right. That's right.
red
No, he was just definitely, he definitely had ideas. I
wine?
never saw him drink white wine ever, ever, ever.
I don't think I did either.
Yeah. And John neither. I wonder if they would, if that was all there was. You know what I mean? I suspect they would. But he was in that Fundus day, he was drinking a beer like most people were. because we were in Germany, you know, we were in Frankfurt. It wasn't summer, but it was fall. So there was probably a new, what do you call it? There was a new line of beer that was, you know, what do you call it when they're seasonal? There was a, probably some seasonal beer that they were all being snobby and drinking. And I just asked for a glass of white wine. And it was a crappy glass of white wine. He was right. It was a waste. Wow. Oh my God, they were so cute.
Yeah.
But even, I mean, really, even to this day, people, you know, write to me and ask me for recipes or ask me for thoughts about how Cage would have dealt with things. If you look at the selected letters, there are a couple of letters. It was an interesting process to do that book because I had to do a great deal of research to figure out who people were. And it turned out that he would write a 2-page letter to somebody completely unknown to me about somebody in their life, maybe a son or a husband, who was suffering from some pretty serious medical thing. And John would be writing to this person all about the macrobiotic diet and the benefits of it. And it would turn out to be a secretary in the music department at some college somewhere, or, you know what I mean? It was like somebody that otherwise was not in his life, but he met them while he was there and they saw these practices of, you know, not ordering room service. Yeah. You know, and cooking in their room or whatever it was. And that persisted. I mean, that was there for him to the very end of his life. Cage wouldn't have thought of changing his diet, I don't think, even to save his life, if, you know, if that had been given to him as an option. Whereas Merce went, whoom, right there.
Yeah, it's curious, the healing aspect of it all as well. I remember our second trip to Japan, Merce insisted that I remind him to buy wasabi to bring back for his sister-in-law Peggy, who had sinus problems.
And they both had very strong ideas about that. You know, I would say Merce more than John. For John, it was less, I don't even know what the word is, less food specific than it was the overall diet. He was really, really rigid, Cage was. So Cage never, once he became macrobiotic, he never again ate meat intentionally. We do have that business with the pasta fagioli, which he accepted very gracefully. No, he never. Whereas Merce always augmented. He always felt, which as I grew to understand the macrobiotic more, made me wonder if Merce ever understood the macrobiotic diet. He goes, really, you don't add chicken to it's against the whole principle of the macrobiotic diet. Oh my God. There was just so many things, though. You know, it'd be fun to do a cookbook someday, Trevor, of, you know, of just practices that went on in that house. Like one thing that I used to make for Merce that he just loved, and John never did it, was if you take a whole head of cauliflower,
yeah,
and you pull the white part away from it and cut it into strips and slather it with lime juice and a bit of sea salt, it makes the most marvelous appetizer and nobody knows what it is.
Yeah.
You know, they bite it. And, you know, I would go through this for about a year. I would say to people, what is that you're eating there? What is that, do you think? And they had no idea, none, because it tastes like nothing else. It tastes like nothing else.
You did a similar treatment to daikon root.
Yeah. Oh, we eat daikon all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and come to learn, I didn't know this at the time, Trevor, but, you know, come to learn that daikon is really an incredibly good digestive aid, you know, like radishes are in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But daikon with lime juice and salt, yum.
Yeah.
And you remember my broccoli coleslaw?
Yeah, but you got that from those cookbooks.
Oh my gosh, Trevor. Yes, let's put in a plug for Martha Stewart.
There was that time we had, Rauschenberg had Synapsis Shuffle, the installation that required it be played like a game of cards with participants dealing with the deck of cards, these panels of paintings. And Bob had selected a variety of different people. Merce was one, and they were all kind of celebrities of one genre or another.
Rauschenberg had lots of them around him.
Yeah. And Chuck Close participated, and Martha Stewart, and...
And Meryl Streep. Was it Meryl Streep?
No, she was not. We saw Meryl Streep at an exhibition of Chuck Close's, and you were there with that. That's where we, I think, have the...
You're absolutely right. And Merce said, oh my goodness, you do so much. I see your movies all the time. And she said, what else am I going to do? Stay home?
Martha Stewart was there, and Merce, staying true to chance, we brought die and a bowl, and he rolled die to choose his panels. But Martha Stewart was very selective at what she wanted hers to look like.
And they could trade, right? They could barter. And
yep, you could trade cards. And that's right. It was a real poker game.
Yeah.
And
these are big, right? Weren't the works were big?
They were taller than I am. They were
8 feet high.
Yeah. And Merce, the die had selected a panel of Merce's that had an image of fruit cups, or a sign from Florida that had a silkscreen from Florida that said fruit cups. And Martha's was of a food theme, and she needed that fruit cup pen. She wanted to trade Merce for it, and Merce said no. And she wanted to know why, because his panel did not look good. His panel together did not look good together.
Oh my God.
That was clear to him. And he said, but I don't care how they look. I'm choosing them by chance. And she said, well, that's just ridiculous. And she walked away.
It's so funny. But, you know, and around that time, Trevor gives Laura for Christmas a subscription to this little cookbook. It was a magazine format called Everyday Food.
Yeah.
And it was a publication by Martha Stewart. And yeah. I remember when first getting it, I wasn't dismissive, but I was dubious. Really, Trevor? Really? Martha Stewart? Huh. And there are still recipes from that book that I made for Merce and you,
yeah,
that I still make. And one of them was my broccoli slaw. That
yeah,
was so good. And that was only made possible really because Merce had permitted mayonnaise in the house. Remember, because yeah, the slaw had a little bit of mayonnaise in it. Not a lot, but a little bit.
But it wasn't egg mayonnaise, was it? It was
no, of course not. It was a vegan mayonnaise. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. The other thing was these chicken thighs, where I would make a paste of ginger, fresh ginger, curry, and lime juice. Again, I would make this paste, and then I would smear that under the skin.
Yeah.
He loved those, loved them. And I still make those from time to time.
Yeah. It was a good
magazine. She went on to, that magazine was supplanted.
Prison.
She did go to prison. You're right. Yes. But in the magazine arena of her life, she stopped publishing that little book, Everyday Food, and started publishing, or maybe they dovetailed for a while, a magazine called Simple Living, which was as much, if not more, focused on her arts and crafts kinds of things, mm-hmm, you know, how to make table decorations, all this nonsense that, you know, that we had no use for.
And did she ever write anything about how to put together a Rauschenberg?
I don't know, Trevor. I don't know. I can say with great assurance that she was never a guest at the Cunningham House for dinner, ever. I think Merce was in his, because I wasn't there for the shuffle piece, but if memory serves, Merce showed an awful lot of kind of delight in turning her down in his retelling me the story, that the madder she got or the more irritated she got, the more he enjoyed it, you know.
There were a lot of great stories from that that event. There was also the story of I can't remember the newscaster who wanted to trade a panel with Chuck Close, and somebody from 60 Minutes, Bill Wallace.
Mike Wallace.
And Chuck Close wrote on a napkin an agreement with Mike Wallace that he would let him have trade panels with him as long as they never let Mickey Rooney do another art report again.
And did he abide by it?
I think so.
See, look at all these fun things. We're going to need to stop, Trevor. Alas, alas. It's just such a pleasure. You're so far away now.
I know. I'm so grateful to our history together and our lives together now and staying in contact. Yeah,
we're still in each other's lives. We just don't get to see each other as often as we used to.
Well, I like this excuse to have a conversation.
It's true. Okay, think of something else. We'll do it again.
Okay. It's a deal.
You take care of yourself, kiddo.
You too. Love you.
Okay, love you too, Trevor. Tonight's program has brought back so many memories, I'm inclined to share another, having nothing to do with food, but with the loft that Cage and Cunningham shared for over 10 years together, and which Cunningham inhabited on his own for another 17 after Cage's death. I'd like to play for you a bit of the audio recording that we captured of the goings-on when So Percussion agreed to come over and play Cunningham's loft, as if it were a grand and most unusual instrument. This took place on April 6th, 2009, just days before Cunningham's 90th birthday and just a few months before his death. Cage had left behind a handful of odd lot percussion instruments, noisemakers really, a lot of them plastic, of the sort that mostly children enjoy, which still laid about the room in which Trevor and I would gather large groups for festive group dinners, particularly over the holidays. So Percussion had themselves brought with them a few of their own handheld instruments, and everything was considered fair game for their unusual musical mix. Cage's instruments, So's instruments, the furniture, walls, floors, plants, even a few ambient sounds in and around the building. What you'll hear is just the last few minutes of their impromptu performance, which was great fun. So Percussion is comprised of Eric Beach, Josh Quillen, Adam Slawinski, and Jason Troiting, four amazingly creative, energetic, and lovable musicians who joined the faculty at Bard College in 2010. At that time, they became co-directors of the Bard Conservatory's undergraduate-only percussion program, which admitted its first students in August 2011. Joining them initially on the teaching faculty at Bard were Greg Zuber, Daniel Druckmann, and Jonathan Haas. Since Bard College is also home to the John Cage Trust, we became fast friends and worked together toward the creation of celebratory concerts for Cage's centenary in 2012.